In addition to the six men who had been at the harbor, Lem called in four more from the temporary HQ at the courthouse. He stationed five along the perimeter of the Oceanside Park, a few hundred yards apart. Their job was to watch the wide avenue that separated the park from a business district, where there were a lot of motels, but also restaurants, yogurt shops, gift shops, and other retail enterprises. All of the businesses had phones, of course, and even some of the motels would have payphones in their front offices. Using any of them, the attorney could alert Travis and Nora Cornell. At this hour, on a Saturday evening, some stores were closed, but some of them, and all of the restaurants, were open. Dilworth must not be permitted to cross the street. The sea wind was stiffening and growing chillier. The men stood with their hands in their jackets, heads tucked down, shivering. Palm fronds were rattled by sudden gusts. Tree-roosting birds shrilled in alarm, then resettled. Lem sent another agent to the southwest corner of the park, out by the base of the breakwater that separated the public beach from the harbor on the other side. His job was to prevent Dilworth from returning to the breakwater, climbing it, and sneaking back across the harbor to phones in another part of the city. A seventh man was dispatched to the northwest corner of the park, down by the waterline, to be sure Dilworth did not proceed north onto private beaches and into residential areas, where he might persuade someone to allow him to use an unmonitored phone. Just Lem, Cliff, and Hank were left to comb through the park and adjoining beach in search of the attorney. He knew he had too few men for the job, but these ten, plus Olbier and Jones at the telephone company, were the only people he had in town. He could see no point ordering in more agents from the Los Angeles office. By the time they arrived, Dilworth would either have been found and stopped, or would have succeeded in calling the Cornells. The roofless all-terrain vehicle was equipped with a roll bar. It had two bucket seats, behind which was a four-foot-long cargo area that could accommodate additional passengers or a considerable amount of gear. Garrison was flat on his stomach on the floor of the cargo hold under a blanket. Two teenage boys were in the bucket seats, and two more were in the cargo hold on top of Garrison, sprawled as if they were sitting on nothing more than a pile of blankets. They were trying to keep the worst of their weight off Garrison, but he still felt half-crushed. The engine sounded like angry wasps, a high, hard buzzing. It deafened Garrison, because his right ear was flat against the cargo bed, which transmitted and amplified every vibration. Fortunately, the soft beach provided a relatively smooth ride. The vehicle stopped accelerating, slowed, and the engine noise dropped dramatically. "Shit," one of the boys whispered to Garrison. "There's a guy ahead with a flashlight flagging us down." They drew to a halt, and over the whispery idling of the engine, Garrison heard a man say, "Where you boys headed?" "Up the beach. That's private property up there. You have any right up there?" "It's where we live," Tommy, the driver, responded. "Is that so? Don't we look like a bunch of spoiled rich kids?" one of them asked, playing wise-ass. "What you been up to?" the man asked suspiciously. "Beach cruising, hanging out, but it got too cold." "You boys been drinking?" "You dolt," Garrison thought as he listened to the interrogator. "These are teenagers you're talking to, poor creatures whose hormonal imbalances have thrown them into a rebellion against all authority for the next couple of years. I have their sympathy because I'm in flight from the cops, and they'll take my side without even knowing what I've done. If you want their cooperation, you'll never get it by bullying them." "Drinking? Hell no," another boy said. "Check the cooler and back if you want. Nothing in it but Dr. Pepper." Garrison, who was pressed up against the ice chest, hoped to God the man would not come around to the back of the vehicle and have a look. If the guy got that close, he would almost surely see there was something vaguely human about the shape under the blanket on which the boys were sitting. "Dr. Pepper, huh? What kind of beer was in there before you drank it all?" "Hey, man," Tommy said. "Why are you hassling us? Are you a cop or what?" "Yeah, in fact, I am." "Where's your uniform?" one of the boys asked. "Undercover." "Listen, I'm disposed to let you kids go on, not check your breath for liquor or anything, but I have to know. Did you see an old white-haired guy on the beach tonight?" "Who cares about old guys?" one of the boys asked. "We're looking for women." "You'd have noticed this old character if you'd seen him. He'd most likely have been wearing swim trunks." "Tonight?" Tommy said. "It's almost December, man. You feel that wind?" "Maybe he was wearing something else." "Didn't see him," Tommy said. "No old guy with white hair. And you guys see him?" The other three said they had not seen any old fart fitting the description they'd been given. And then they were allowed to drive on, north from the public beach, into a residential area of seaside homes and private beaches. When they'd rounded a low hill and were out of sight of the man who had stopped them, they pulled the blanket off Garrison, and he sat up with considerable relief. Tommy dropped the other three boys off at their houses and took Garrison home with him because his parents were out for the evening. He lived in a house that looked like a ship with multiple decks, slung over a bluff, all glass and angles. Following Tommy into the foyer, Garrison caught a glimpse of himself in a mirror. He looked nothing like the dignified silver-haired barrister known by everyone in the city's courts. His hair was wet, dirty, and matted. His face was smeared with dirt. Sand, bits of grass, and threads of seaweed were stuck to his bare skin and tangled in his gray chest hair. He grinned happily at himself. "There's a phone in here," Tommy said from the den. After preparing dinner, eating, cleaning up, and then worrying about Einstein's loss of appetite, Nora and Travis had forgotten about calling Garrison Dilworth and thanking him for the care with which he had packaged and shipped her paintings. They were sitting in front of the fireplace when she remembered. In the past, when they had called Garrison, they had done so from public phones in Carmel. That had proved to be an unnecessary precaution. And now, tonight, neither of them was in the mood to get in the car and drive into town. "We could wait and call him from Carmel tomorrow," Travis said. "It'll be safe to phone from here," she said. "If they'd made a link between you and Garrison, he'd have called and warned us off." "He might not know they've made a link," Travis said. "He might not know they're watching him." "Garrison would know," she said firmly. Travis nodded. "Yeah, I'm sure he would. So it's safe to call him." She was halfway to the phone when it rang. The operator said, "I have a collect call for anyone from a Mr. Garrison Dilworth in Santa Barbara. Will you accept the charges?" A few minutes before 10 o'clock, after conducting a thorough but fruitless search of the park and beach, Lem reluctantly admitted that Garrison Dilworth had somehow gotten past him. He sent his men back to the courthouse and harbor. He and Cliff also drove back to the harbor to the sport yacht from which they had based their surveillance of Dilworth. When they put in a call to the Coast Guard cutter pursuing the Amazing Grace, they learned that the attorney's lady had turned around well short of Ventura and was heading north along the coast back to Santa Barbara. She entered the harbor at 10:36. At the empty slip belonging to Garrison, Lem and Cliff huddled in the crisp wind, watching her bring the Hinckley smoothly and gently into its mooring. It was a beautiful boat, beautifully handled. She had the gall to shout at them, "Don't just stand there. Grab the lines and help tie her up." They obliged primarily because they were anxious to speak with her and could not do so until the Amazing Grace was secured. Once their assistance had been rendered, they stepped through the railing gate. Cliff was wearing topsiders as part of his boater's disguise, but Lem was in street shoes and not at all sure-footed on the wet deck, especially as the boat was rocking slightly. Before they could say a word to the woman, a voice behind them said, "Excuse me, gentlemen." Lem turned and saw Garrison Dilworth in the glow of a dock lamp, just boarding the boat behind them. He was wearing someone else's clothes. His pants were much too big in the waist, cinched in with a belt. They were too short in the legs, so his bare ankles were revealed. He wore a voluminous shirt. "Please excuse me, but I've got to get into some warm clothes of my own and have a pot of coffee." Lem said, "God damn it, to thaw out these old bones." After a gasp of astonishment, Cliff Soames let out a hard bark of laughter, then glanced at Lem and said, "Sorry." Lem's stomach cramped and burned with an incipient ulcer. He did not wince with pain, did not double over, did not even put a hand on his gut, gave no indication of discomfort, because any such sign from him might increase Dilworth's satisfaction. Lem just glared at the attorney, at the woman, then left without saying a word. "That damn dog," Cliff said, as he fell into step at Lem's side on the dock, "sure inspires one hell of a lot of loyalty." Later, bedding down in a motel because he was too tired to close the temporary field office tonight and go home to Orange County, Lem Johnson thought about what Cliff had said. Loyalty. One hell of a lot of loyalty. Lem wondered if he had ever such felt a strong bond of loyalty to anyone, as the Cornells and Garrison Dilworth apparently felt toward the retriever. He tossed and turned, unable to sleep, and he finally realized there was no use trying to switch off his inner lights until he satisfied himself that he was capable of the degree of loyalty and commitment that he had seen in the Cornells and their attorney. He sat up in the darkness, leaning against the headboard. Well, sure, he was damn loyal to his country, which he loved and honored, and he was loyal to the agency. But to another person? All right, Karen, his wife, he was loyal to Karen in every way, in his heart, mind, and gonads. He loved Karen. He had loved her deeply for almost 20 years. Yeah, he said, aloud in the empty motel room at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, if you're so loyal to Karen, why aren't you with her now? But he wasn't being fair to himself. After all, he had a job to do, an important job. That's the trouble, he muttered. You've always, always got a job to do. He slept away from home more than 100 nights a year. 1 in 3. And when he was home, he was distracted half the time, his mind on the latest case. Karen had once wanted children, but Lem had delayed the start of a family, claiming that he could not handle the responsibility of children until he was sure his career was secure. Secure? He said. Man, you inherited your daddy's money. You started out with more of a cushion than most people. If he was as loyal to Karen as those people were to that mutt, then his commitment to her should mean that her desires ought to come before all others. If Karen wanted a family, then family should take precedence over career. Right? At least he should have compromised and started a family when they were in their early 30s. His 20s could have gone to the career, his 30s to child-rearing. Now he was 45, almost 46, and Karen was 43, and the time for starting a family had passed. Lem was overcome with a great loneliness. He got out of bed, went into the bathroom in his shorts, switched on the light, and stared hard at himself in the mirror. His eyes were bloodshot and sunken. He had lost so much weight on this case that his face was beginning to look downright skeletal. Stomach cramps seized him, and he bent over, holding onto the sides of the sink, his face in the basin. He had been afflicted only for the past month or so, but his condition seemed to be worsening with startling speed. The pain took a long time to pass. When he confronted his reflection in the mirror again, he said, "You're not even loyal to your own self, you asshole. You're killing yourself, working yourself to death, and you can't stop. Not loyal to Karen, not loyal to yourself, not really loyal to your country or the agency when it comes right down to it. Hell, the only thing you're totally and unswervingly committed to is your old man's crackpot vision of life as a tightrope walk." Crackpot. That word seemed to reverberate in the bathroom long after he'd spoken it. He had loved and respected his father, had never said a word against him. Yet today he had admitted to Cliff that his dad had been impossible, and now, crackpot vision. He still loved his dad and always would, but he was beginning to wonder if a son could love a father and at the same time completely reject his father's teachings. A year ago, a month ago, even a few days ago, he would have said it was impossible to hold fast to that love and still be his own man. But now, by God, it seemed not only possible, but essential, that he separate his love for his father from his adherence to his father's workaholic code. "What's happening to me?" he wondered. "Freedom? Freedom at last, at 45? Squinting into the mirror, he said, "Almost 46. Chapter 9. Part 1. Sunday, Travis noted that Einstein still had less of an appetite than usual. But on Monday, November 29th, the retriever seemed fine. On Monday and Tuesday, Einstein finished every scrap of his meals and he read new books. He sneezed only once and did not cough at all. He drank more water than in the past, though not an excessive amount. If he seemed to spend more time by the fireplace, if he padded through the house less energetically, well, winter was swiftly settling upon them, and animals' behavior changed with the seasons. At a bookstore in Carmel, Nora bought a copy of The Dog Owner's Home Veterinary Handbook. She spent a few hours at the kitchen table, reading, researching the possible meanings of Einstein's symptoms. She discovered that listlessness, partial loss of appetite, sneezing, coughing, and unusual thirst could signify 100 ailments, or mean nothing at all. About the only thing it couldn't be is a cold, she said. Dogs don't get colds like we do. But by the time she got the book, Einstein's symptoms had diminished to such an extent that she decided he was probably perfectly healthy. In the pantry off the kitchen, Einstein used the Scrabble tiles to tell them, fit as a fiddle. Stooping beside the dog, stroking him, Travis said, I guess you ought to know better than anyone. Why say fit as a fiddle? Replacing the tiles in their lucite tubes, Travis said, well, because it means healthy. But why does it mean healthy? Travis thought about the metaphor, fit as a fiddle, and realized he was not sure why it meant what it did. He asked Nora, and she came to the pantry door, but she had no explanation for the phrase either. Pawing out more letters, pushing them around with his nose, the retriever asked, why say sound as a dollar? Sound as a dollar, meaning healthy or reliable, Travis said. Stooping beside them, speaking to the dog, Nora said, that one's easier. The United States dollar was once the soundest, most stable currency in the world. Still is, I suppose. For decades, there was no terrible inflation in the dollar like in some other currencies. No reason to lose faith in it. So folks said, I'm as sound as a dollar. Of course, the dollar isn't what it once was, and the phrase isn't as fitting as it used to be, but we still use it. Why still use it? Because we've always used it, Nora said, shrugging. Why say healthy as a horse? Horses never sick? Gathering up the tiles and sorting them back into their tubes, Travis said, no, in fact, horses are fairly delicate animals in spite of their size. They get sick pretty easily. Einstein looked expectantly from Travis to Nora. Nora said, we probably say healthy as a horse because horses look strong and seem like they should never get sick, even though they get sick all the time. Face it, Travis told the dog, we humans say things all the time that don't make sense. Pumping the letter-dispensing pedals with his paw, the retriever told them, you are a strange people. Travis looked at Nora, and they both laughed. Beneath, you are a strange people, the retriever spelled, but I like you anyway. Einstein's inquisitiveness and sense of humor seemed, more than anything else, to indicate that, if he had been mildly ill, he was now recovered. That was Tuesday. On Wednesday, December 1st, while Nora painted in her second-floor studio, Travis devoted the day to inspecting his security system and to routine weapons maintenance. In every room, a firearm was carefully concealed under furniture, or behind a drape, or in a closet, but always within easy reach. They owned two Mossberg pistol-grip shotguns, four Smith & Wesson Model 19 combat magnums loaded with .357s, two .38 pistols that they carried with them in the pickup and Toyota, an Uzi carbine, two Uzi pistols. They could have obtained their entire arsenal legally from a local gun shop once they purchased a house and established residence in the county, but Travis had not been willing to wait that long. He had wanted to have the weapons on the first night they settled into their new home. Therefore, through Van Dyne in San Francisco, he and Nora had located an illegal arms salesman and had acquired what they needed. Of course, they could not have bought conversion kits for the Uzis from a licensed gun dealer, but they were able to purchase three such kits in San Francisco, and now the Uzi carbine and pistols were fully automatic. Travis moved from room to room, checking that the weapons were properly positioned, that they were free of dust, that they did not need to be oiled, and that their magazines were fully loaded. He knew that everything would be in order, but he just felt more comfortable if he conducted this inspection once a week. Though he had been out of uniform for many years, the old military training and methodology were still a part of him, and under pressure they surfaced more quickly than he had expected. Taking a Mossberg with them, he and Einstein also walked around the house, stopping at each of the small infrared sensors that were, as much as possible, placed inconspicuously against backdrops of rocks or plants, snug against the trunks of a few trees, at the corners of the house, and beside an old rotting pine stump at the edge of the driveway. He had bought the components on the open market from an electronics dealer in San Francisco. It was dated stuff, not at all state-of-the-art security technology, but he chose it because he was familiar with it from his days in Delta Force, and it was good enough for his purposes. Lines from the sensors ran underground, to an alarm box in one of the kitchen cupboards. When the system was switched on at night, nothing larger than a raccoon could come within 30 feet of the house or enter the barn at the back of the property without tripping the alarm. No bells would ring and no sirens would blare because that would alert the outsider and might run it off. They didn't want to chase it away. They wanted to kill it. Therefore, when the system was tripped, it turned on clock radios in every room of the house, all of which were set at low volume so as not to frighten off an intruder, but high enough to warn Travis and Nora. Today, all the sensors were in place as usual. All he had to do was wipe off the light film of dust that had coated the lenses. "The palace moat is in good repair, my lord," Travis said. Einstein woofed approval. In the rust-red barn, Travis and Einstein examined equipment that they hoped would provide a nasty surprise for the outsider. In the northwest corner of the shadowy interior, to the left of the big rolling door, a pressurized steel tank was clamped in a wall rack. In the diagonally opposite southeast corner at the back of the building, beyond the pickup and car, an identical vessel was bolted to an identical rack. They resembled large propane tanks of the sort people used at summer cabins for gas cooking, but they did not hold propane. They were filled with nitrous oxide, which was sometimes inaccurately called laughing gas. The first whiff did exhilarate you and make you want to laugh, but the second whiff knocked you out before the laugh could escape your lips. Dentists and surgeons frequently use nitrous oxide as an anesthetic. Travis had purchased it from a medical supply house in San Francisco. After switching on the barn lights, Travis checked the gauges on both tanks. Full pressure. In addition to the large rolling door at the front of the barn, there was a smaller man-sized door at the rear. These were the only two entrances. Travis had boarded over a pair of windows in the loft. At night, when the alarm system was engaged, the smaller rear door was left unlocked in the hope that the outsider, intending to scout the house from the cover of the barn, would let itself into the trap. When it opened the door and crept into the barn, it would trigger a mechanism that would slam and lock the door behind it. The front door, already locked from outside, would prevent an exit in that direction. Simultaneous with the springing of the trap, the large tanks of nitrous oxide would release their entire contents in less than 1 minute, because Travis had fitted them with a high-pressure emergency release valve tied in with the alarm system. He had caulked all of the draft-admitting cracks in the barn and had insulated the place as thoroughly as possible in order to ensure that the nitrous oxide would be contained within the structure until one of the doors was unlocked from the outside and opened to vent the gas. The outsider could not take refuge in the pickup or the Toyota, for they would be locked. No corner in the barn would be free of the gas. Within less than a minute, the creature would collapse. Travis had considered using poisonous gas of some kind, which he probably could have obtained on the underground market, but he had decided against going to that extreme, because if something went wrong, the danger to him and Nora and Einstein would be too great. Once gas had been released and the outsider had succumbed, Travis could simply open one of the doors, vent the barn, enter with the Uzi carbine, and kill the beast where it lay unconscious. At worst, even if the time taken airing out the building gave the outsider a chance to regain consciousness, it would still be groggy and disoriented and easily dispatched. When they had ascertained that everything in the barn was as it should be, Travis and Einstein returned to the yard behind the house. The December day was cool but windless. The forest surrounding the property was preternaturally still. The trees stood motionless under a low sky of slate-colored clouds. Travis said, "Is the outsider still coming?" With a quick wag of the tail, Einstein said, "Yes." "Is it close?" Einstein sniffed the clean, winter crisp air. He padded across the yard to the perimeter of the northern woods and sniffed again, cocked his head, peered intently into the trees. He repeated this ritual at the southern end of the property. Travis had the feeling that Einstein was not actually employing his eyes, ears, and nose in search of the outsider. He had some way of monitoring the outsider that was far different from the means by which he would track a cougar or squirrel. Travis perceived that the dog was employing an inexplicable sixth sense. Call it psychic, or at least quasi-psychic. The retriever's use of its ordinary senses was probably either the trigger by which it engaged that psychic ability, or mere habit. At last, Einstein returned to him and whined curiously. "Is it close?" Travis asked. Einstein sniffed the air and surveyed the gloom of the encircling forest, as if he could not decide on an answer. "Einstein? Is something wrong?" Finally, the retriever barked once. "No." "Is the outsider getting close?" A hesitation. Then, "No." "Are you sure?" "Yes." "Really sure?" "Yes." At the house, as Travis opened the door, Einstein turned away from him, padded across the back porch, and stood at the top of the wooden steps, taking one final look around at the yard and at the peaceful, shadowed, soundless forest. Then, with a faint shiver, he followed Travis inside. Throughout the inspection of the defenses during the afternoon, Einstein had been more affectionate than usual, rubbing against Travis's legs a great deal, nuzzling, seeking by one means or another to be petted or patted or scratched. That evening, as they watched television, then played a three-way game of Scrabble on the living room floor, the dog continued to seek attention. He kept putting his head in Nora's lap, then in Travis's. He seemed as if he would be content to be stroked and have his ears gently scratched until next summer. From the day of their first encounter in the Santa Ana foothills, Einstein had gone through spells of purely doggy behavior, and it was hard to believe that he was, in his own way, as intelligent as a man. Tonight, he was in one of those moods again. In spite of his cleverness at Scrabble, in which his score was second only to Nora's, and in which he took devilish pleasure forming words that made sly references to her as yet unnoticeable pregnancy, he was nonetheless, this night, more of a dog than not. Nora and Travis chose to finish the evening with a little light reading, detective stories. But Einstein did not want them to bother inserting a book in his page-turning machine. Instead, he lay on the floor in front of Nora's armchair and went instantly to sleep. "He still seems a little draggy," she said to Travis.
"He ate all his dinner, though. And we did have a long day."
The dog's breathing as it slept was normal, and Travis was not worried. Actually, he was feeling better about their future than he had for some time. The inspection of their defenses had given him renewed confidence in their preparations, and he believed they would be able to handle the outsider when it arrived. And thanks to Garrison Dilworth's courage and dedication to their cause, the government had been stymied, perhaps for good, in its efforts to track them down. Nora was painting again with great enthusiasm, and Travis had decided to use his real estate license, under the name of Samuel Hyatt, to go back to work once the outsider had been destroyed. And if Einstein was still a little draggy, well, he was certainly more energetic than he had been for a while, and was sure to be himself by tomorrow or the day after at the latest. That night, Travis slept without dreaming. In the morning, he was up before Nora. By the time he showered and dressed, she was up too. On her way into the shower, she kissed him, nibbled on his lip, and mumbled sleepy vows of love. Her eyes were puffy, and her hair was mussed, and her breath was sour. But he would have rushed her straight back into bed if she had not said, "Try me this afternoon, Romeo. Right now, the only lust in my heart is for a couple of eggs, bacon, toast, and coffee." He went downstairs, and starting in the living room, opened the interior shutters to let in the morning light. The sky looked as low and gray as it had been yesterday, and he would not be surprised if rain fell before twilight. In the kitchen, he noticed that the pantry door was open, the light on. He looked in to see if Einstein was there, but the only sign of the dog was the message that he had spelled out sometime during the night. "Fiddle broke. No doctor. Please. Don't want to go back to lab. Afraid. Afraid." Oh, shit. Oh, Jesus. Travis stepped out of the pantry and shouted, "Einstein!" No bark. No sound of padding feet. The shutters still covered the kitchen windows, and most of the room was not illuminated by the glow from the pantry. Travis snapped on the lights. Einstein was not there. He ran into the den. The dog was not there either. Heart pounding almost painfully, Travis climbed the stairs two at a time, looked in the third bedroom that would one day be a nursery, and then in the room that Nora used as a studio. But Einstein was not in either place,
And he was not in the master bedroom, not even under the bed where Travis was desperate enough to check, and for a moment he could not figure out where in the hell the dog had gone. And he stood listening to Nora singing in the shower. She was oblivious of what was happening. And he started into the bathroom to tell her that something was wrong, horribly wrong, which was when he thought of the downstairs bath. So he ran out of the bedroom and along the hall and descended the stairs so fast he almost lost his balance, almost fell. And in the first floor bath, between the kitchen and the den, he found what he most feared to find. The bathroom stank. The dog, ever considerate, had vomited in the toilet, but had not possessed the strength, or perhaps the clarity of mind, to flush. Einstein was lying on the bathroom floor on his side. Travis knelt next to him. Einstein was still, but not dead. Not dead, because he was breathing. He inhaled and exhaled with a rasping noise. He tried to lift his head when Travis spoke to him, but he did not have the strength to move. His eyes, Jesus, his eyes. Ever so gently, Travis lifted the retriever's head and saw that those wonderfully expressive brown eyes were slightly milky. A watery yellow discharge oozed from the eyes. It had crusted in the golden fur. A similar sticky discharge bubbled in Einstein's nostrils. Putting a hand on the retriever's neck, Travis felt a laboring and irregular heartbeat. "No," Travis said. "Oh, no, no. It's not going to be like this, boy. I'm not going to let it happen like this." He lowered the retriever's head to the floor, got up, turned toward the door, and Einstein whimpered almost inaudibly, as if to say that he did not want to be left alone. "I'll be right back," Travis promised. "Just hold on, boy, I'll be right back." He ran to the stairs and climbed faster than before. Now his heart was beating with such tremendous force that he felt as if it would tear loose of him. He was breathing too fast, hyperventilating. In the master bathroom, Nora was just stepping out of the shower, naked and dripping. Travis's words ran together in panic. "Get dressed quick! We've got to get to the vet now! For God's sake, hurry!" Shocked, she said, "What's happened? Einstein, hurry! I think he's dying!" He grabbed a blanket off the bed, left Nora to dress, and hurried downstairs to the bathroom. The retriever's ragged breathing seemed to have gotten worse in just the minute that Travis had been away. He folded the blanket twice, to a fourth of its size, then eased the dog onto it. Einstein made a pained sound, as if the movement hurt him. Travis said, "Easy, easy, you'll be all right." At the door, Nora appeared, still buttoning her blouse, which was damp because she had not taken time to towel off before dressing. Her wet hair hung straight. In a voice choked with emotion, she said, "Oh, Furface, no, no." She wanted to stoop and touch the retriever, but there was no time to delay. Travis said, "Bring the pickup alongside the house." While Nora sprinted to the barn, Travis folded the blanket around Einstein as best he could, so only the retriever's head, tail, and hind legs protruded. Trying unsuccessfully not to elicit another whimper of pain, Travis lifted the dog in his arms and carried him out of the bathroom, across the kitchen, out of the house, pulling the door shut behind him but leaving it unlocked, not giving a damn about security right now. The air was cold. Yesterday's calm was gone. Evergreens swayed, shivered, and there was something ominous in the way their bristling, needled branches pawed at the air. Other leafless trees raised black, bony arms toward the somber sky. In the barn, Nora started the pickup. The engine roared. Travis cautiously descended the porch steps and went out to the driveway, walking as if he were carrying an armload of fragile antique china. The blustery wind stood Travis's hair straight up, flapped the loose ends of the blanket, and ruffled the fur on Einstein's exposed head, as if it were a wind with a malevolent consciousness, as if it wanted to tear the dog away from him. Nora swung the pickup around, heading out, and stopped where Travis waited. She would drive. It was true what they said. Sometimes in certain special moments of crisis, in times of great emotional tribulation, women are better able to bite the bullet and do what must be done than men often are. Sitting in the truck's passenger seat, cradling the blanket-wrapped dog in his arms, Travis was in no condition to drive. He was shaking badly, and he realized that he had been crying from the time he had found Einstein on the bathroom floor. He had seen difficult military service, and he had never panicked or been paralyzed with fear while on dangerous Delta Force operations. But this was different. This was Einstein. This was his child. If he had been required to drive, he'd probably have run straight into a tree, or off the road into a ditch. There were tears in Nora's eyes, too. But she didn't surrender to them. She bit her lip and drove as if she'd been trained for stunt work in the movies. At the end of the dirt lane, they turned right, heading north on the twisty Pacific Coast Highway toward Carmel, where there was sure to be at least one veterinarian. During the drive, Travis talked to Einstein, trying to soothe and encourage him. "Everything's gonna be all right, just fine. It's not as bad as it seems. You'll be good as new." Einstein whimpered and struggled weakly in Travis's arms for a moment, and Travis knew what the dog was thinking. He was afraid that the vet would see the tattoo in his ear, would know what it meant, and would send him back to Bannadyne. "Don't you worry about that fur face. Nobody's gonna take you away from us. By God, they aren't. They'll have to walk through me first, and they aren't gonna be able to do that. No way." "No way," Nora agreed grimly. But in the blanket, cradled against Travis's chest, Einstein trembled violently. Travis remembered the lettered tiles on the pantry floor. "Fiddle, broke, afraid, afraid." "Don't be afraid," he pleaded with the dog. "Don't be afraid. There's no reason to be afraid." In spite of Travis's heartfelt assurances, Einstein shivered and was afraid. And Travis was afraid, too. Part 2. Stopping at an Arco service station on the outskirts of Carmel, Nora found the vet's address in a phone book and called him to be sure he was in. Dr. James Keene's office was on Dolores Avenue at the southern end of town. They pulled up in front of the place at a few minutes before 9. Nora had been expecting a typically sterile-looking veterinary clinic, and was surprised to find that Dr. Keene's offices were in his home, a quaint two-story country English house of stone and plaster and exposed timbers with a roof that curved over the eaves. As they hurried up the stone walk with Einstein, Dr. Keene opened the door before they reached it, as if he had been on the lookout for them. A sign indicated that the entrance to the surgery was around the side of the house, but the vet took them in at the front door. He was a tall, soulful-faced man with sallow skin and sad brown eyes, but his smile was warm, and his manner was gracious. Closing the door, Dr. Keene said, "Bring him this way, please." He led them swiftly along a hallway with an oak parquet floor protected by a long, narrow oriental carpet. On the left, through an archway, lay a pleasantly furnished living room that actually looked lived in, with footstools in front of the chairs, reading lamps, laden bookshelves, and crocheted afghans folded neatly and conveniently over the backs of some chairs for when the evenings were chilly. A dog stood just inside the archway, a black Labrador. It watched them solemnly, as if it understood the gravity of Einstein's condition, and it did not follow them. At the rear of the large house, on the left side of the hall, the vet took them through a door into a clean white surgery. Lined along the walls were white enameled and stainless steel cabinets with glass fronts, which were filled with bottles of drugs, serums, tablets, capsules, and the many powdered ingredients needed to compound more exotic medicines. Travis gently lowered Einstein onto an examination table and folded the blanket back from him. Nora realized that she and Travis looked every bit as distraught as they would have if they'd been bringing a dying child to a doctor. Travis's eyes were red, and though he was not actively crying at the moment, he continually blew his nose. The moment she had parked the pickup in front of the house and had pulled on the handbrake, Nora had ceased to be able to repress her own tears. Now she stood on the other side of the examination table from Dr. Keene, with one arm around Travis, and she wept quietly. The vet was apparently used to strong emotional reactions from pet owners, for he never once glanced curiously at Nora or Travis. Never once indicated by any means that he found their anxiety and grief to be excessive. Dr. Keene listened to the retriever's heart and lungs with a stethoscope, palpated his abdomen, examined his oozing eyes with an ophthalmoscope. Through those and several other procedures, Einstein remained limp, as if paralyzed. The only indications that the dog still clung to life were his faint whimpers and ragged breathing.
"It's not as serious as it seems," Nora told herself as she blotted her eyes with a Kleenex.
Looking up from the dog, Dr. Keene said, "What's his name?"
"Einstein," Travis said.
"How long have you owned him?"
"Only a few months."
"Has he had his shots?"
"No," Travis said. "Damn it, no."
"Why not?"
"It's complicated," Travis said.
"But there are reasons that shots couldn't be gotten for him."
"No reason's good enough," Keene said disapprovingly. "He's got no license, no shots. It's very irresponsible not to see that your dog is properly licensed and vaccinated."
"I know," Travis said miserably. "I know." "What's wrong with Einstein?" Nora said.
As she thought, hoped, prayed,
"It's not as serious as it seems."
Lightly stroking the receiver, Keene said, "He's got distemper." Einstein had been moved to a corner of the surgery, where he lay on a thick, dog-sized foam mattress that was protected by a zippered plastic coverlet. To prevent him from moving around, if at any time he had the strength to move, he was tethered on a short leash to a ring bolt in the wall. Dr. Keene had given the retriever an injection.
"Antibiotics," he explained. "No antibiotics are effective against distemper, but they're indicated to avoid secondary bacteriological infections."
He had also inserted a needle in one of the dog's leg veins and had hooked him to an IV drip to counteract dehydration. When the vet tried to put a muzzle on Einstein, both Nora and Travis objected strenuously.
"It's not because I'm afraid he'll bite," Dr. Keene explained. "It's for his own protection, to prevent him from chewing at the needle. If he has the strength, he'll do what dogs always do to a wound, lick and bite at the source of the irritation."
"Not this dog," Travis said. "This dog's different."
He pushed past Keene and removed the device that bound Einstein's jaws together. The vet started to protest, then thought better of it.
"All right, for now. He's too weak now anyway."
Still trying to deny the awful truth, Nora said,
"But how could it be so serious? He showed only the mildest symptoms, and even those went away over a couple of days."
"Half the dogs who get distemper never show any symptoms at all," the vet said, as he returned a bottle of antibiotics to one of the glass-fronted cabinets and tossed a disposable syringe in a waste can.
"Others have only a mild illness. Symptoms come and go from one day to the next. Some, like Einstein, get very ill. It can be a gradually worsening illness, or it can change suddenly from mild symptoms to this. But there is a bright side here."
Travis was crouched beside Einstein, where the dog could see him without lifting his head or rolling his eyes, and could therefore feel attended, watched over, loved. When he heard Keene mention a bright side, Travis looked up eagerly.
"What bright side? What do you mean?"
"The dog's condition, before it contracts distemper, frequently determines the course of the disease. The illness is most acute in animals that are ill-kept and poorly nourished. It's clear to me that Einstein was given good care."
Travis said, "We tried to feed him well, to make sure he got plenty of exercise."
"He was bathed and groomed almost too often," Nora added.
Smiling, nodding approval, Dr. Keene said, "Then we have an edge. We have real hope." Nora looked at Travis, and could meet her eyes only briefly, before he had to look away, down at Einstein. It was left to her to ask the dreaded question.
"Doctor, he's going to be all right, isn't he? He won't die, will he?"
Apparently James Keene was aware that his naturally glum face and drooping eyes presented merely in repose an expression that did little to inspire confidence. He cultivated a warm smile, a soft yet confident tone of voice, and an almost grandfatherly manner that, although perhaps calculated, seemed genuine and helped balance the perpetual gloom God had seen fit to visit upon his countenance. He came to Nora, put his hands on her shoulders.
"My dear, you love this dog like a baby, don't you?"
She bit her lip and nodded.
"Then have faith.
Have faith in God, who watches over sparrows, so they say. And have a little faith in me, too, because believe it or not, I'm pretty good at what I do, and I deserve your faith."
"I believe you are good," she told him.
Still squatting beside Einstein, Travis said thickly, But the chances. What are the chances? Tell us straight.
Letting go of Nora, turning to Travis, Keen said, Well, the discharge from his eyes and nose isn't as thick as it can get. Not nearly. No pus blisters in the abdomen. You say he's vomited, but you've seen no diarrhea?
No, just vomiting, Travis said.
His fever's high, but not dangerously so. Has he been slobbering excessively?
No,
Nora said. Fits of head shaking and chewing on air, sort of as if he had a bad taste in his mouth?
No,
Travis and Nora said simultaneously. Have you seen him run in circles or fall down without reason? Have you seen him lie on his side and kick violently as if he were running? Aimless wandering around a room, bumping into walls, jerking and twitching, anything like that?
No, no,
Travis said. And Nora said, My God, could he get like that? If he goes into second stage distemper, yes, Keen said. Then there's brain involvement. Epileptic like seizures. Encephalitis. Travis came to his feet in a sudden lurch. He staggered toward Keen, then stopped, swaying. His face was pale, his eyes filled with a terrible fear.
Brain involvement? If he recovered, would there be brain damage?
An oily nausea rippled in Nora. She thought of Einstein with brain damage, as intelligent as a man, intelligent enough to remember that he had once been special, and to know that something had been lost. And to know that he was now living in a dullness, a grayness, that his life was somehow less than what it had once been. Sick and dizzy with fear, she had to lean against the examination table. Keen said, Most dogs in second stage distemper don't survive. But if he made it, there would, of course, be some brain damage. Nothing that would require he be put to sleep. He might have lifelong chorea, for instance, which is involuntary jerking or twitching, rather like palsy, and often limited to the head. But he could be relatively happy with that, lead a pain-free existence, and he could still be a fine pet. Travis almost shouted at the vet, To hell with whether he'd make a fine pet or not! I'm not concerned about physical effects of the brain damage. What about his mind? Well, he'd recognize his masters, the doctor said. He'd know you and remain affectionate toward you. No problem there. He might sleep a lot. He might have periods of listlessness, but he'd almost certainly remain housebroken. He wouldn't forget that training. Shaking, Travis said, I don't give a damn if he pisses all over the house as long as he can still think.
Think?
Dr. Keen said, clearly perplexed. Well, what do you mean exactly? He is a dog, after all. The vet had accepted their anxious, grief-racked behavior as within the parameters of normal pet owner reactions in a case like this. But now, at last, he began to look at them strangely. Partly to change the subject and dampen the vet's suspicion, partly because she simply had to know the answer, Nora said, All right, but is Einstein in second stage distemper? Keen said, From what I've seen so far, he's still in the first stage, and now that treatment has begun, If we don't see any of the more violent symptoms during the next 24 hours, I think we have a good chance of keeping him in first stage and rolling it back.
And there's no brain involvement in first stage?
Travis asked with an urgency that again caused Keen to furrow his brow. No, not in first stage.
And if he stays in first stage, Nora said, he won't die?
In his softest voice and most comforting manner, James Keen said, Well, now. The chances are very high that he'd survive just first stage distemper, and without any after effects. I want you to realize that his chances of recovery are quite high. But at the same time, I don't want to give you false hope. That'd be cruel. Even if the disease proceeds no further than first stage, Einstein could die. The percentages are on the side of life, but death is possible. Nora was crying again. She thought she had gotten a grip on herself. She thought she was ready to be strong, but now she was crying. She went to Einstein, sat on the floor beside him, and put one hand on his shoulder, just to let him know that she was there. Keen was becoming slightly impatient with, and thoroughly baffled by, their tumultuous emotional response to the bad news. A new note of sternness entered his voice as he said, Listen, all we can do is give him top-flight care and hope for the best.
He'll have to remain here, of course, because distemper treatment is complex and ought to be administered under veterinary supervision. I'll have to keep him on the intravenous fluids, antibiotics, and there'll be regular anticonvulsants and sedatives if he begins to have seizures.
Under Nora's hand, Einstein shivered, as if he'd heard and understood the grim possibilities.
All right. Okay, yes, Travis said. Obviously, he's got to stay here in your office. We'll stay with him.
There's no need, Keen began.
Right, yes, no need, Travis said quickly. But we want to stay. We'll be okay. We can sleep here on the floor tonight.
No, I'm afraid that's not possible, Keen said.
Yes, it is. Oh, yes, entirely possible, Travis said, babbling now in his eagerness to convince the vet. Don't worry about us, Doctor. We'll manage just fine. Einstein needs us here, so we'll stay. The important thing is that we stay, and of course, we'll pay you extra for the inconvenience.
But I'm not running a hotel.
We must stay, Nora said firmly.
Keen said, Now, really, I'm a reasonable man, but...
With both hands, Travis seized the vet's right hand and held it tightly, startling Keen.
Listen, Dr. Keen, please, let me try to explain. I know this is an unusual request. I know we must sound like a couple of lunatics to you, but we've got our reasons, and they're good ones. This is no ordinary dog, Dr. Keen. He saved my life.
And he saved mine, too, Nora said, in a separate incident.
And he brought us together, Travis said. Without Einstein, we never would have met, never married, and we'd both be dead.
Astonished, Keen looked from one to the other.
You mean he saved your lives literally? And in two separate incidents?
Literally,
Nora said. And then brought you together?
Yes, Travis said. Changed our lives in more ways than we can count or ever explain.
Held fast in Travis's hands, the vet looked at Nora, lowered his kind eyes to the wheezing retriever, shook his head and said,
I'm a sucker for heroic dog stories. I'll want to hear this one for sure.
We'll tell you all about it, Nora promised.
But she thought, it'll be a carefully edited version.
When I was 5 years old, James Keen said, I was saved from drowning by a black Labrador.
Nora remembered the beautiful black lab in the living room and wondered if it was actually a descendant of the animal that had saved Keen, or just a reminder of the great debt he owed to dogs.
All right, Keen said. You can stay.
Thank you,
Travis's voice cracked.
Thank you.
Freeing his hand from Travis, Keen said, But it'll be at least 48 hours before we can be at all confident that Einstein will survive. It'll be a long haul.
48 hours is nothing, Travis said. 2 nights of sleeping on the floor, we can handle that.
Keen said, I have a hunch that for you two, 48 hours is going to be an eternity under the circumstances. He looked at his wristwatch and said, Now, my assistant will arrive in about 10 minutes, and shortly after that we'll open the office for morning hours. I can't have you underfoot in here while I'm seeing other patients, and you wouldn't want to wait in the patient lounge with a bunch of other anxious owners and sick animals. That would only depress you. You can wait in the living room, and when the office is closed late this afternoon, you can return here to be with Einstein.
Can we peek in on him during the day? Travis asked.
Smiling, Keen said,
All right, but just a peek.
Under Nora's hand, Einstein finally stopped shivering. Some of the tension went out of him, and he relaxed, as if he had heard they would be allowed to remain close by, and was immensely comforted. The morning passed at an agonizingly slow pace. Dr. Keene's living room had a television set, books, and magazines, but neither Nora nor Travis could get interested in TV or reading. Every half hour or so, they slipped down the hall, one at a time, and peeked in at Einstein. He never seemed worse, but he never seemed any better either.
Keen came in once and said, By the way, feel free to use the bathroom, and there's cold drinks in the refrigerator. Make coffee if you want.
He smiled down at the black lab at his side.
And this fella is Pooka. He'll love you to death if you give him a chance.
Pooka was indeed one of the friendliest dogs Nora had ever seen. Without encouragement, he would roll over, play dead, sit up on his haunches,
and then comes snuffling around, tail wagging, to be rewarded with some petting and scratching. All morning, Travis ignored the dog's pleas for affection, as if petting Pooka would in some way be a betrayal of Einstein and would ensure Einstein's death of distemper. However, Nora took some comfort from the dog and gave it the attention it desired. She told herself that treating Pooka well would please the gods, and that the gods would then look favorably upon Einstein. Her desperation produced in her a superstition just as fierce, if different from, that which gripped her husband. Travis paced. He sat on the edge of a chair, head bowed, his face in his hands. For long periods, he stood at one of the windows, staring out, not seeing the street that lay out there, but some dark vision of his own. He blamed himself for what had happened, and the truth of the situation, which Nora recalled for him, did nothing to lessen his irrational sense of guilt. Facing a window, hugging himself as if he were cold, Travis said quietly, "Do you think Keen saw the tattoo?"
"I don't know. Maybe not."
"Do you think there's really been a description of Einstein circulated to vets? Will Keen know what the tattoo means?"
"Maybe not," she said. "Maybe we're too paranoid about this."
But after hearing from Garrison and learning of the lengths to which the government had gone to prevent him from getting a warning to them, they knew that an enormous and urgent search for the dog must be still underway. So there was no such thing as being too paranoid. From noon until two, Dr. Keene closed the office for lunch. He invited Nora and Travis to eat with him in the big kitchen. He was a bachelor who knew how to take care of himself, and he had a freezer stocked with frozen entrees that he had prepared and packaged himself. He defrosted individually wrapped slabs of homemade lasagna, and with their help made three salads. The food was good, but neither Nora nor Travis was able to eat much of it. The more Nora knew of James Keene, the more she liked him. He was light-hearted in spite of his morose appearance, and his sense of humor ran toward self-deprecation. His love of animals was a light within that gave him a special glow. Dogs were his greatest love, and when he spoke of them, his enthusiasm transformed his homely features and made of him a handsomer and quite appealing man. The doctor told them of the black lab, King, that had saved him from drowning when he was a child, and he encouraged them to tell him how Einstein saved their lives. Travis recounted a colorful story about going hiking and almost walking into an injured and angry bear. He described how Einstein warned him off, and then when the half-mad bear gave chase, how Einstein challenged and repeatedly foiled the beast. Nora was able to tell a story closer to the truth. Harassment by a sexual psychopath whose attack had been interrupted by Einstein and who had been held by the retriever until the police arrived. Keene was impressed. He really is a hero. Nora sensed that the stories about Einstein had so completely won the vet over that if he did spot the tattoo and knew what it meant, he might conceivably put it out of his mind and might let them go in peace once Einstein was recovered. If Einstein recovered. But as they were gathering up the dishes, Keene said, "Sam, I've been wondering why your wife calls you Travis." They were prepared for this. Since assuming new identities, they had decided that it was easier and safer for Nora to continue calling him Travis, rather than trying to use Sam all the time and then at some crucial moment slipping up. They could claim that Travis was a nickname she'd given him, that the origin was a private joke, with winks at each other and foolish grins. They could imply there was something sexual about it, something much too embarrassing to explain further. That was how they handled Keene's question. But they were in no mood to wink and grin foolishly with any conviction, so Nora was not sure they carried it off. In fact, she thought their nervous and inept performance might increase Keene's suspicions, if he had any. Just before afternoon office hours were to begin, Keene received a call from his assistant, who'd had a headache when she had gone to lunch, and who now reported that the headache had been complicated by an upset stomach. The vet was left to handle his patients alone, so Travis quickly volunteered his and Nora's services. "We've got no veterinary training, of course, but we can handle any manual labor involved."
"Sure," Nora agreed.
And between us, we've got one pretty good brain. We could do just about anything else you showed us how to do.
They spent the afternoon restraining recalcitrant cats and dogs and parrots and all sorts of other animals while Jim Keane treated them.